books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm Robert Kirkwood, and today I'll be chatting to the multi-award-winning author Andrew Miller about the writing of and the narration of his book, The Land in Winter. The Land in Winter, written by Andrew Miller, is described as a masterful, page-turning examination of the minutiae of life and a dazzling chronicle of the human heart. The Land in Winter is read by Andrew Miller himself.
He was lying on a varnished wooden board, the top of a boxed-in radiator. The board was exactly as wide as his shoulders, and he knew, from painful experience, he must sit up like a man emerging from his own coffin. Roll over, and he would be on the floor. Above the radiator, a tall window was covered with thin curtains, a pattern of stripes, green, brown, and red. He lifted a corner of the cloth and looked out. Deep space, the heart of night, a single small light left burning through fog above the door of the industrial therapy department. The time? He sifted it from the air, from the many small clues it gave. Presences, absences. He had owned, when he first arrived, a watch with a brown leather strap, one of his better things. He had managed to keep hold of it for 2 weeks before it was stolen. He knew who had taken it. A man who choked to death in the refectory 6 months later, inhaling a mouthful of mashed potato. The watch must have been given to the dead man's family, along with a dozen other effects from his locker. It might have puzzled them, the nice watch they didn't know he'd had. He let the curtain drop. He wondered what had woken him. There was no shouting, no sound of running feet, no alarm. The place was hushed. The room he was in, a common room, a big room with a high ceiling, was deserted. But somewhere, something had changed. Something had fallen or risen.
The Land in Winter is set in the very early 1960s. It's the sort of 1960s before it really knows it's the 1960s. More sort of Acker-Bilk than Rolling Stones. And it's set in the southwest of England, in a village not so far from Bristol, perhaps. And it's two couples, youngish married couples, not very, very young, but sort of in their late 20s, early 30s. On the one side of a field, we've got the doctor and his wife. And on the other side of the field, a rather unlikely farmer and his wife. So these two couples are there at the beginning of this sort of astonishing winter that there had been nothing like it for 100 years, and we've had nothing really like it since. The sea froze for a couple of miles from the coast, and it was it's astonishing period that went on from sort of Christmas until March. And as I think quite a lot of people, there's a lot of folk memory around this time. And I get readers come and talk to me about their memories of being children, usually in this time. And it was an incredibly fierce winter that cut off lots of towns and villages, particularly in the southwest, actually, which is where the book is set, which took a lot of the worst of the weather, some really extraordinary blizzards. So life changed very dramatically and really rather suddenly in that sort of late December of 1962.
He swung himself to sit on the board, legs dangling. He patted his hair, he still had some, and looked down the length of the room. The stiff little tables with their stiff little chairs, the foil ashtrays. On one wall, screwed to the wall and out of reach, was a painting of hot air balloons. On the opposite wall, also screwed on, also out of reach, was a photograph of the young queen in her coronation robes. Other than for his shoes, he was fully dressed. A brown, pinstriped suit with a cardigan under the jacket, the cardigan a present from his daughter, the younger one, last Christmas or the Christmas before. Red wool and warm, slightly too big, or becoming so. The older girl had stopped coming years ago. He must have worried about that once. Not any more. Awake now, clear-headed in one of those lulls when the things they gave him had lost their force, he stood, steadied himself, and set off. In his socks, he could move almost soundlessly. From the common room, he entered the corridor. It was a wooden floor in the common room, but in the corridor there were lino tiles, geometries in bright colours. You had to be careful not to get lost on it, not to try stepping only from green square to green square, or find yourself marooned on a red triangle. The tiles were new and part of a scheme to brighten things up. The administrator had visited them. He had addressed them in the chapel after Sunday service, spoken from the black wood of the pulpit. "Time for a change, ladies and gentlemen. We are entering the age of opportunity."
Now, it's set in the early 60s, but the tagline is, "Where do you hide when you can't leave home?" Was that inspired by an event perhaps a bit closer to us in time?
I mean, you know what? It didn't actually occur to me right at the beginning that there was this sort of connection. But of course, when somebody pointed it out to me, it was very obvious. And yes, it became very difficult to move around. The schools were shut and so on. So there were lots of things going on then that we became kind of familiar with during the pandemic. Lots of sort of sudden shortages in the shops. We all remember sort of some of the rather curious shortages that we experienced around the time of the pandemic. And just the sense of being a sort of sense of dislocation, a sense of the normal having been rather abruptly brought to an end. That certainly would have been a part of it. I mean, this was a wartime generation, of course, though, in 1962. These were people who, in a sense, I think, had a kind of preparation for something of this kind. And I think they generally responded to it pretty well. They were used to toughing it out. You know, and also, in a sense, we were saved by various things like the railways, which pre-beaching was still going to lots of sort of towns and villages that now they no longer go to. And they were sort of dug out by gangs of bizarrely kind of patient and tolerant and long-suffering men in cloth caps who sort of lived on cigarettes and bacon sandwiches and cups of tea. So it was, but you're right, there's a very definite parallel with COVID, which I say didn't really occur to me right at the beginning, and what it did was sort of blindingly obvious.
You mentioned the war, and that's a motif in a few of your books, because the echoes go on far longer after the guns have stopped.
Well, that's right. I mean, they do. I mean, I think in Britain, the war wasn't really over till sort of, I don't know, the mid-1970s in some way, or, you know, I think punk rock was the end of the war. And it's so far as when we, you know, growing up, my generation, certainly, you know, all the films, the comics, all the stories, you know, that our parents told us, you know, just little anecdotes of, you know, day-to-day life in the war. And, you know, it was around finishing your food, because, you know, there's a great sort of awareness of sort of the paucity of things and how necessary it was to everything should be used and used properly. So, yeah, I want, and it's, you know, 17 years, the book begins 17 years after the end of the Second World War. And of course, these are people, the characters in the novel, they were all sort of teenagers through the war, not quite old enough to have taken an active part in the war. So but, you know, it was 5 years of their growing up shaped by this experience. And yeah, I wanted it to sort of, you know, in a sense, they're caught between looking forwards to a time where all kinds of new possibilities for living will emerge and are beginning to just be sensed, you know, the possibilities of living a different life, but also constantly glancing back over their shoulders at the world of Britain at war, of the world at war, and also some of the things that have come out since then in terms of what people had learnt about what had happened during the war. And I'm thinking obviously of the camps and how, you know, Britain was, I mean, this is a story of my mother's, you know, going to the cinema as still a girl, really, and seeing a Pathé newsreel film about the camps and seeing obviously images that nothing could have really prepared her for or anyone. And just, you know, once those images are in your head, they're never going anywhere else.
My dad said that he grew up during rationing, and he said the first words he learned to read was a sign that appeared in a shop more often than not that said "No sweets today."
Fantastic! I love that. In some ways, rationing got worse because, I mean, Britain was obviously bankrupt after the war, and then we, you know, the Lend-Lease ended very abruptly. The Americans had sort of had enough of it. There were other things they wanted to attend to. And so, you know, for the first time, bread went on the ration, you know, after the war. So I think that period in the late 40s is a rather dark period. There wasn't no longer the kind of slight excitement that I guess war brings, particularly if you're not, if the odds are not too bad in your favor. But it's once that was over and it was just lack. And I think, no sweets today. That's a great little anecdote.
And I believe it was an anecdote of your mother's that inspired The Land in Winter.
Yeah, it was in a way. And I mean, really a very bare story about a day when she and my doctor father, my father was a GP, ran across the field between their house and the cottage and the farmhouse on the other side of the field, because there was an emergency that they needed to attend. Well, that my father certainly as a doctor needed to be there for, and my mother was there because at that point she was still, I think she was still quite sort of involved in his working life, you know, and I think that was important to her. And I think the story probably was about that, about her involvement in something that. And then later, my father had rather, you know, was a traditional man of his time, I guess, and had rather different ideas about what her involvement should be. You know, that she should basically stay at home and look after children and cook his supper. So, but this was an occasion when they sort of went together to something that was, you know, to an emergency. And so that, yeah, a little story which just for some reason stayed with me and then kind of emerged as I started to think about this world of the early 60s and of this extraordinary winter. And then just in the midst, yeah, this a sense of these two people running to answer an emergency on the other side of a field. And that gave me, yeah, it gave me a sort of armature, you know, gave me a sort of, that became the very basic kind of model or shape around which I began to build this novel.
Rita lay on her right side, blonde hair on the shadow-coloured pillow, her face in a frown as she backed out of a dream of the club, some version of itself, Chinese lanterns flickering in a breeze that came through the open door and down the empty stairs. No band on stage, the mirrored shelves behind the bar all bare. The place had been raided? She'd been there once when it was. There were complicated arrangements between Eugene and the police that didn't always hold up. Sometimes they were apologetic, orders from above, and sometimes they were angry. The sight of a Negro bandleader with a diamond in his tie-pin, the smell of hashish down there, and the girls, black girls and white girls, who weren't much interested in dancing with policemen. Eugene fretted about them. He said they were skittish as horses. You had to settle them down. It wasn't just about money. But in her dream, the club was a place no one was coming back to, not Eugene or Gloria, not even the police. The stairs were narrower than the real ones had been, narrower and longer. At intervals, what is time in a dream, lit like an X-ray by the neon above the street door? Something had happened in the world above. The H-bomb? Or a comet the size of London smashing the world off its axis. Go up there and she might be the last one. Endless winter in an endless night. And yet she had to see. She had to know.
And we'll have more from author Andrew Miller after this.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
This is an RNIB talking book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. The very first books in the studios were recorded on wax disc.
Of course, recording on wax discs means that you have to have a one take, basically. If you make a mistake during that recording, the whole disc is just wiped clean. So you have these narrators we had then had to record for about 25 minutes without making a mistake, and they were really adept at covering over mistakes, apparently. I remember one of our narrators called Andrew Timothy. He used to talk to us about recording on wax discs, and he was very clear about what he has to do. If he made a mistake, he didn't actually make a mistake, he just sort of covered it over and carried on recording. And one of his favourite things he used to say is that the important thing is you say a word that you've never heard of before, say it with such conviction that people who have been saying it correctly for the last 20 years are now wondering whether they are saying it correctly.
Quickly and with confidence.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, Braille, along with many other benefits such as Braille music scores, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now I return to my chat with Andrew Miller about his novel The Land in Winter, which he narrated himself.
She stirred and began to unwind herself from the sheets. The whiteness of day showed between the not quite perfectly closed curtains. There was an alarm clock on a chair on Bill's side of the bed, the alarm set for 5. The time now almost 9. The room was cold, though she'd known it colder. At the foot of the bed was a paraffin heater, but her nose told her it wasn't lit. Bill was nervous of it. He thought it would gas them with its fumes or set the bedspread on fire. He said the bedspread looked like the kind that would burn well. She swung out her legs and sat on the edge of the bed. The dream was familiar enough, the mood if not the details. She looked down at her feet. She had on a pair of Bill's boot socks and was wearing a set of his pyjamas with the cuffs rolled up. Under the jacket, she wore a long-sleeved vest. That at least was hers. She listened for sounds of activity from the yard and heard, as if her sitting up was its cue, the bellowing of a cow. A train clattered past. She had learned in the last 2 years to tell a goods train from a passenger train, locals from the express. She shuffled out to the corridor and down to the bathroom. There were no curtains or blinds at the window, but they weren't needed. The nearest house, the doctor's, was on the far side of the field, though today, through the fog, she couldn't see it at all. She could barely see the field.
So is Eric based on your father?
Well, that's a great question. Yes and no. I couldn't perhaps have published this book while my father was alive. I think that'd be fair to say. It is not an attempt at a portrait of my father, but there are things in there which would have seemed as if they might be. I think that's perhaps the best way of putting it. So I would not have, I could not have written this book or published this book while my father was alive. My father died about 10 years ago. And there's enough sort of correspondence between Eric in the novel and my father for it to have been awkward.
Now, how about the research for this? You use newspapers and radio as a way of the couples staying in touch. Are those the actual documents of the time, or are those an invention?
No, a lot of it was the documents of the time. I mean, I used a lot of the British newspaper archive a lot in my researches. That was a really key resource, which I went back to again and again. I mean, and actually, once you start doing that, I could have done that forever. It's so interesting to see, in the sense of the newspapers giving a picture of who they think we are, you know, who they think, you know, obviously the different newspapers are a slightly different picture, but a sort of portrait of who we are now. Often it was things like the advertisements that I was most interested in, curious little advertisements for I don't know, sort of household goods or whatever it was. That seemed to really give a way into that, to that time. Radio, yes, obviously radio had been really important for some time between before the 1960s, and obviously all through the war, it had played a really crucial role. Television, of course, was becoming the big thing by the early 60s. I think I've read somewhere that more people had televisions in 1962 than had fridges. It was, I guess it's a little more interesting than a fridge, perhaps, television. But and as houses were quite cold, perhaps you didn't need a fridge quite as much as you did later. So yeah, that was very important. And the television, you know, it was very interesting that as a medium that was being discussed, was this going to be just a sort of to entertain the masses, or was this a serious medium where, you know, serious questions would be debated, and there would be sort of serious dramas and so on, and it was sort of, you know, a little bit the radio. There'd been a discussion like this around radio as well. You know, was it to lift us up in some way, or was it just to sort of make us laugh?
Now, talking of audio, that's a tenuous link, yeah. But let's go with it. This is the first of your books that you have narrated. First of all, why did you decide to narrate this one?
Well, because there's a fee attached, you know? And I thought, why am I, you know, much as I love actors, you know, I also need to pay the rent. So I suggested, also because it had been suggested to me by people after readings, and so I've always enjoyed giving readings, and once in a while, particularly as audiobooks have become more popular and more people have been listening to them, it was just been suggested to me a few times that, you know, why don't you do it? And so when this time rolled around, and they, as usual, they sort of started to suggest various voice actors, and I listened to a couple of them, and then I just suggested, like, you know, could I have a go? And they were a little bit sort of, I think the feeling generally is that they don't really, you know, that there are skills involved that you know, writers might not have, and that better to have an actor. But they decided to let me at least try. So I went to a little studio in Bristol and sat in a sort of broom cupboard, really, for 4 days with a very sensitive microphone in front of me and a producer on the other side of the glass who any stumble, any sort of slight sort of blurring of a word, it was stopped, rolled back, do it again. It was a slightly maddening process. And very tiring, certainly the first couple of days. I sort of got into it after that, but the first couple of days, my throat started to go, and I thought, this, you know, am I going to actually be able to finish this? So I had a lot of, I did at some point think, yeah, I understand now why they have actors to do this, because, you know, dialogue, obviously, tricky, really tricky. You got two people. I mean, I remember this, there's one of the, Eric, the doctor, has a Birmingham accent. And I think I could do a few accents, but Birmingham, poof. So I had to spend a long time on sort of, I don't know, YouTube or and actually there was somebody, I came across somebody working in a shop in my little local town, which is in the West Country, but who had a wonderful Birmingham accent. And I sort of just had to keep going in there and listening to her to try to get a little, because what I wanted was a hint of, it's much harder, I think, to do a slight accent rather than a broad one. You know, but I didn't want, you know, broad Brummy. I wanted something quite slight, hints of. And that's that's difficult. So it was, I slightly had bitten off more really than I could chew, but with a very good producer, we pushed on, and I think, I mean, the responses I've had have been mostly positive, but then perhaps it's the people don't bother sort of passing on the less positive ones perhaps. But it's anyway, and the advantage for the writer, of course, is that I know the book. I know every sentence in the book. I know where I intend emphasis to fall. And that is obviously a huge advantage. What you get sometimes with actors is the impression of, you know, they can give an impression of sense that isn't really necessarily based on the sense of what they're reading. It's a kind of actory trick, I think, which allows them to give the impression of them knowing the text rather better than they do.
There was a full-length mirror in the bathroom with a black japanned frame they had bought in a bric-a-brac shop on the Gloucester Road in Bristol. The woman had said it was French. It was not screwed to the wall, that was a job still waiting to be done, just propped up against the faded seashells of the old wallpaper. She pulled up the pyjama jacket and the vest, held them in one hand just below her breasts. She studied the reflection of her belly, then turned side on and twisted her neck to look again. She touched her skin and flinched at the contact of her cold fingers. Something? Nothing? She let the cloth fall and raised her gaze to meet her own blue eyes, puffy with sleep. She reached up to pat her hair. "You've let yourself go, dearie," she said. She went to the wash basin. The water shuddered in the pipes. There was a back boiler on the Raeburn in the kitchen, but the Raeburn was as old as the house. When they moved in, she and Bill had peered inside it, like Hepburn and Bogart scratching their heads over the engine of the African Queen. Sometimes water came in a wild gush and your head was lost in steam. Sometimes it was cold as iron and burned you the other way. This morning it was, she thought, about the same temperature as the fog. She washed her face, then cleaned her teeth. The bristles of the toothbrush turned pink, and when she spat into the basin, a little blood swirled around the plug hole. She used the toilet and waggled her toes in the socks. When she was done, she looked out the window again. Only minutes had passed, but she could see the field now, and beyond it the blush of the doctor's roof tiles, his house like a ship anchored off the coast, riding out the weather. As she watched, a light came on in one of the upstairs windows. "Good morning," she said.
The big question is, though, will you do it again?
I would, actually. I think I would now, if they let me, because it actually, in the end, although quite a sort of testing sort of experience, it was a rather satisfying one, and I feel, you know, I've heard my stuff read by all kinds of different people, and sometimes it works wonderfully. But if you're doing it yourself, well, there's only you to blame, really. If it doesn't come over, and I always know how I want it to sound, and so I can at least have a good crack at getting it to sound like that.
Do you think that might affect the writing of your next book? Because always in the back of your mind, it's going to be, I'm going to have to say this out loud at some point.
Well, I mean, the thing is, of course, I do that anyway. I'm doing that all the time when I'm writing. I speak the book, if you like. I mean, I write it, and if you stood outside my study door, you would hear this constant sort of mumbling going on, because I'm pretty much almost as I write it, I am also reading it, and if not at exactly the same time, I will read it very shortly afterwards. So that element of it is always there. I'm not performing it in that sense, but I am always wanting to hear it. And as I get into the editing stage, I will often record it. I'll do it on, you know, GarageBand or something on my computer, and then listen back to it, perhaps with the manuscript on my lap. You know, I can hear if I stumble over a passage, why was that? You know? Oh, is there something sort of inherently unreadable about that sentence? In which case, perhaps I need to look at it again. So it won't change things in that sense, what I do now, because that's kind of what I do anyway. It's what I've always done.
Now that it is available in audio and in Braille, it's accessible to someone for whatever reason, sight loss, dyslexia, doesn't have a relationship with print. Is that important to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it'd be horrible to think of the book being unavailable to people who want it for reasons that, well, that we can actually overcome with Braille and audio. If it wasn't available to them, yeah, that would be awful. So I'm delighted. And actually, the whole audiobook thing, as you know very well, has grown massively in recent years. And that's a very nice development. And of course, it's not just people who struggle with print. It's all manner of folk, isn't it? You know, people listen in their car and so on. And so it's been a really interesting way that people have come to my books and just books in general recently. But yeah, I'm delighted that that's the case. And that the Braille version. I didn't know that, but I'm very pleased to hear it.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the book from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you give us a little audio description of the cover of The Land in Winter?
Yeah, I'll try. I'm doing it from memory because I'm away at the moment. I don't have a copy of it in front of me. But obviously, we took a lot of time to think about the cover. They originally, the publishers, I'll just give you a bit of background, sent me something that looked like the sort of December page on a calendar. You know, it looked like on a sort of rather pleasant, friendly kind of calendar with pictures of woodland and snow and so on. And I thought, this is incredibly dull. No one's going to be interested in this. So I started to send them things that I found online, you know, found in Pinterest and so on, that had a bit more atmosphere, I suppose. And also I wanted something that gave a little more sense of the period without necessarily having some very obvious kind of clues all over it. But what we ended up with, I mean, what they do, they send sort of versions. They send, you know, as we got closer to basically what I wanted, they would send different versions of it. One has to clear rights, for example. So it's not just one has a free choice of any image one comes across. You don't. So what we ended up with was a black and white photograph, not with a kind of very sharp definitions. So there's a sense of it being a fairly old photograph, not something, it's not sort of super crisp, put it that way. Partly though, it's not super crisp because it's taken in the midst of, not a blizzard, but one can imagine a fine snow blowing across the image and sort of softening it and making things slightly blur into the background. It's a country scene. There's a track. There's a bit of fencing. There's what looks like moorland. And there's also what I think, again, these things are not in fantastically clear. They're kind of, I say, blurred by this veil of snow. But there's a farmhouse, a sort of large old farmhouse somewhere in the background. And there's not very few trees or any kind of sign of things of that kind. There are no people. There are no cars. But what we did, because they sent me this image in two ways. One was, as you would expect to see it, with, you know, the sky at the top and cloud at the bottom. And the other was turned on its side. And so that I immediately liked, because it's strange. And this is quite a strange book. It's a world that's been, if you like, to some extent, tipped on its side. So I went for that one. So you're actually seeing this image stood on end. I mean, apart from anything else, I just liked the idea that people would have to sort of lift it up and turn it around a little bit to see, oh, I see what that is now.
In the kitchen, she'd pulled on one of Bill's jumpers. There were no proper women's clothes for this kind of life. She stood beside the cream steel of the Raeburn, leaned right over it. She knew which bits not to touch, then turned to warm her backside. The cat, large, brindled, was sitting on the table between the wicker ed basket and her knitting things. Red wool, size 12 needles, the beginnings of a bobble hat. The cat had come with the farm. If it had a name, they didn't know it. It was not affectionate. It had drawn blood from both of them, from Bill several times. It gave the impression of intending to outlast them, of being confident of doing so. Out of the cat's reach, on top of the old meat safe, was a saucepan of cold spaghetti and tomato sauce, the remains of last night's supper. Spaghetti was one of the things she could do. There had been a time in her life, the powwow club, the temping, when spaghetti was the main source of nourishment, packets of it in thick blue paper from the Italian delicatessen on Park Row. You only needed one ring to make a meal. You could add anything, a tin of peas, margarine, ketchup. You could eat it bare if you had to, with just a pinch of salt. She lifted three or four strands from the saucepan and lowered them into her mouth. Like a baby bird, she thought. The thought made her tearful. She wiped her eyes with the back of her hand and teased out more spaghetti, tomato on her chin, on Bill's jumper. Her morning job, the first, the only one that really mattered, was feeding the hens. Bill would have let them out after milking, but by now they would be frantic. She wetted her fingers under the tap, wiped them on a cloth, took the basket from the table and went to the back door. She leaned against the wall and pushed her feet into gumboots. You had to fight to get the door open. Like almost everything else in the house, it was not well made. It swelled with the damp. It was not even a particularly old house. Above the front door, a date was gouged into the plaster, 1907, the year before her father was born. She tugged. She would have liked the strength to tear it off its hinges. She enjoyed the thought of moving through the world with unstoppable force. Attack of the 50-foot woman. Doors, men, whatever tried to check her progress, flicked away like spent matches. She tugged again, swore at it, and the door gave. She stood on the step, breathing in the morning, the dissolving weave of the fog.
Another clip of Andrew Miller reading from The Land in Winter. Available in all formats, ebook, audio and print commercially, and also available in audio and braille from RNIB. And Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Ray Sawyer. I've been reading for the RNIB Talking Books for 25 years now. My first book was Coming From Behind by Howard Jacobson, but the one I think I enjoyed most was Writing Home by Alan Bennett. Not just because it's wonderful writing, but although not officially an autobiography, you got a sense of his life as all his selections of writings were put in chronological order. I particularly like The Lady in the Van. The Talking Book studios, as now, were very close to where Alan Bennett lived, and I was able to walk up and actually see the driveway and the house in which the lady lived for 25 years. And quite by chance, Alan Bennett was sitting on his front step reading The Guardian when I turned up.
This van, there were to be three others in the course of the next 20 years, was originally brown. But by the time it had reached the Crescent, it had been given a coat of yellow. Miss S. was fond of yellow. It's the papal colour. And was never content to leave her vehicles long in their original trim. Sooner or later she could be seen moving slowly round her immobile home, thoughtfully touching up the rust from a tiny tin of primrose paint, looking, in her long dress and sun hat, much as Vanessa Bell would have looked had she gone in for painting Bedford vans. Miss S. never appreciated the difference between car enamel and ordinary gloss paint, and even this she never bothered to mix. The result was that all her vehicles ended up looking as if they'd been given a coat of badly made custard or plastered with scrambled egg. Still, there were few occasions on which one saw Miss Shepherd genuinely happy, and one of them was when she was putting paint on.
I love doing the Talking Books because, well, you get to play parts that you'd never get to play in real life. In fact, doing a book is a bit like doing a one-man show, only one that's 25 hours long.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK.
The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
And finally, on today's Read On, let's rejoin Andrew Miller for some book recommendations in Books of My Life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Yes, I think there definitely was. Not just one, of course, but one that really sticks in my head, which I guess I read when I was probably about 9. And that's Rosemary Sutcliffe's Eagle of the Ninth, which is Rosemary Sutcliffe was a very popular writer of often historical, not always, I think, but often historical stories for young readers. And Eagle of the Ninth is the time of the Romans in Britain. And of course, the Ninth Legion was lost. It's disappeared in the north of the border where so many things disappear. She was just a wonderful writer. It's a thrilling story. And it's also, she writes, I think, a really rather gorgeous, quite lush sort of prose. So that was a book which, and I didn't just read it, of course. I mean, I was 9. I kind of lived it. You know, I was that young Roman centurion. You know, it wasn't just a sort of a passive activity of sitting and taking in a story. I lived them. I would act them out. I think anyone looking at this strange bookish boy might have scratched their heads and wondered, how's this going to go? That would be the one that I would pick out.
From the Fossway westward to Isca Domnoniorum, the road was simply a British trackway, broadened and roughly metalled, strengthened by corduroys of logs in the softest places, but otherwise unchanged from its old estate, as it wound along among the hills, thrusting farther and farther into the wilderness. It was a busy road, and saw many travellers. Traders with bronze weapons and raw yellow amber in their ponies' packs, country folk driving shaggy cattle or lean pigs from village to village, sometimes a band of tawny-haired tribesmen from further west, strolling harpers and quack oculists too, or a light-stepping hunter with huge wolfhounds at his heel. And from time to time, a commissariat wagon going up and down to supply the Roman frontier post. The road saw them all, and the cohorts of the eagles, for whom all other travellers must make way. There was a cohort of leader-clad auxiliaries on the road today, swinging along at the steady legion's pace that had brought them down from Isca Silurium at 20 miles a day. The new garrison coming to relieve the old one at Isca Domnoniorum. On they went, following the road that now ran out on a causeway between sodden marsh and empty sky, now plunged into deep boar-hunted forest, or lifted over bleak uplands where nothing grew save firs and thorn scrub. On, with never a halt nor a change of rhythm, marching century by century, the sun bright on the standard at their head, and the rolling dust cloud kicked up over the pack train behind. At the head of the column marched the Pilus Prior Centurion, the cohort commander, the pride that shone from him, showing clearly that this was his first command. They were, he had long since decided, a command worthy of anyone's pride. 600 yellow-haired giants recruited from the tribes of Upper Gaul, with a natural fighting power of mountain cats, drilled and hammered into what he firmly believed to be the finest auxiliary cohort ever to serve with the Second Legion. They were a newly joined cohort. Many of the men had not yet proved themselves in action, and the spear shaft of their standard had no honours on it, no gilded laurel wreath, nor victor's crown. The honours were all to win, perhaps during his command.
That's George Hagen reading from Three Legions by Rosemary Sutcliffe, comprising of The Eagle of the Ninth, The Silver Branch and The Lantern Bearers, available in audio from R&IB Talking Books. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Well, I think pretty much anything by Penelope Fitzgerald, a writer who, every time I go back to her work, I'm blown away. But I reread recently The Bookshop, a little story of hers about, I mean, they're all very short books but they also are very big books in some way. But this is one about a woman trying to open a little bookshop in a Suffolk village in, I think, the 1950s, late 50s, and finding it uphill work. The books are funny. I mean, there's a very wry comedy there, but they are also, she was a fantastically sort of intelligent woman who seemed to know more about the world than any one person somehow should. She's always on the side of, I suppose, of people who are not managing that well, of people who are a little bit eccentric, of people who are slight oddballs or in some way outcast or not thriving particularly in the worlds that she writes about. And I love that she's always, she loves it. They're always strange children, precocious children who somehow also seem to see rather deeply into sort of adult shenanigans. Yeah, there's a lovely comedy to it, but behind that, this is a very real world of very real struggles in a sort of, 1950s, rather pared down Britain. So I recommend pretty much anything from Penelope Fitzgerald.
In 1959, Florence Green occasionally passed a night when she wasn't absolutely sure whether she'd slept or not. This was because of her worries as to whether to purchase a small property, the old house, with its own warehouse on the foreshore, and to open the only bookshop in Hardborough. The uncertainty probably kept her awake. She'd once seen a heron flying across the estuary and trying, while it was on the wing, to swallow an eel which it had caught. The eel, in turn, was struggling to escape from the gullet of the heron and appeared a quarter, a half, or occasionally three-quarters of the way out. The indecision expressed by both creatures was pitiable. They'd taken on too much. Florence felt that if she hadn't slept at all, and people often say this when they mean nothing of the kind, she must have been kept awake by thinking of the heron. She had a kind heart, though that's not of much use when it comes to the matter of self-preservation. For more than 8 years of half a lifetime, she'd lived at Hardborough on the very small amount of money her late husband had left her, and had recently come to wonder whether she hadn't a duty to make it clear to herself and possibly to others that she existed in her own right. Survival was often considered all that could be asked in the cold and clear East Anglian air. Kill or cure, the inhabitants thought. Either a long old age or immediate consignment to the salty turf of the churchyard. She was in appearance small, wispy and wiry, somewhat insignificant from the front view and totally so from the back. She wasn't much talked about, not even in Hardborough, where everyone could be seen coming over the wide distances and everything seen was discussed. She made small seasonal changes in what she wore. Everybody knew her winter coat, which was the kind that might just be made to last another year. In 1959, when there was no fish and chips in Harborough, no laundrette, no cinema, except on alternate Saturday nights, the need of all these things was felt. But no one had considered, certainly hadn't thought of Mrs. Green as considering, the opening of a bookshop.
That's Carol Marsh reading from The Bookshop by Penelope Fitzgerald, one of many Penelope Fitzgerald books available from RNIB. Is there a book you've read recently you'd like to recommend? Doesn't have to be contemporary, but it's something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind.
Well, just it's something very different now, and not fiction. And it's Naomi Klein's book, Doppelganger, quite a big, fat book. And it really deals, initially anyway, with a kind of confusion that she started to notice between, because she's an activist. She's online all the time. She's on social media all the time. She's putting things out into the world all the time, essays and so on, and comments. But there's another woman, Naomi Wolf, who also does all of that. And they were constantly getting confused. They're women of similarish age, both Jewish women, both in America. And this was sort of all right for a while because Naomi Wolf was, I guess, talking about the kinds of things was promoting things that Naomi Klein was kind of interested in and supported and thought well of. And then as COVID came around, Naomi Wolf started to drift into something very different and into what Naomi Klein refers to as the mirror world, the world of conspiracies and a kind of quite sort of extravagant sort of theories about what was going on in the world, and started to appear on people like Steve Bannon's sort of War Room podcasts and to drift into territory run by the far right in America. And so at that point, of course, Naomi Klein, who's very definitely a sort of old school leftist, became very uncomfortable. And this confusion was no longer something that she could really be easy with. But the book really, which is, I say, quite a long book, then really becomes a fantastic sort of unpicking of recent times and of very confusing recent times as people, try to make sense of what's been going on politically in the United States, but also to some extent in the United Kingdom, and some of the kind of strange alliances that have been going on. She talks about one between not the far right and the far left, but the far right and the far out, as she refers to it, a kind of new age, which I certainly noticed during COVID, and I suspect many people did, that there were strange alliances that you would not have predicted, but came about. It's not a kind of them and us thing, because the point she's trying to make is that the people in the mirror world are very definitely connected to the people of the other side of the mirror, and that we can't simply disown them. They are also us. I just found it a fascinating and really helpful guide to now. She's an astonishingly good guide to a complex time.
In my defense, it was never my intent to write this book. I did not have time, no one asked me to, and several people strongly cautioned against it. Not now. Not with the literal and figurative fires roiling our planet. And certainly not about this. Other Naomi. That's how I refer to her now. This person with whom I have been chronically confused for over a decade. My big-haired doppelganger. A person whom so many others appear to find indistinguishable from me, a person who does many extreme things that cause strangers to chastise me or thank me or express their pity for me. The very fact that I refer to her with any kind of code speaks to the absurdity of my situation. For a quarter of a century, I have been a person who writes about corporate power and its ravages. I sneak into abusive factories in faraway countries and across borders to military occupations. I report in the aftermath of oil spills and Category 5 hurricanes. I write books of big ideas about serious subjects. And yet, in the months and years during which this text came into being, a time when cemeteries ran out of space and billionaires blasted themselves into outer space, everything else that I had to write or might have written appeared only as an unwanted intrusion, a rude interruption. Would I participate in events leading up to a key United Nations climate summit? No, I'm sorry, I'm overcommitted. Comment on the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, the 20th anniversary of 9/11, the Russian invasion of Ukraine? No, no, and no again. In June 2021, as this project began to truly spiral out of my control, a strange new weather event dubbed a heat dome descended on the southern coast of British Columbia, the part of Canada where I now live with my family. The thick air felt like a snarling, invasive entity with malevolent intent. More than 600 people died, most of them elderly. An estimated 10 billion marine creatures were cooked alive on our shores. An entire town went up in flames. It's rare for this out-of-the-way, sparsely populated spot to make international headlines. But the heat dome made us briefly famous. An editor asked if I, as someone engaged in the climate change fight for 15 years, would file a report about what it was like to live through this unprecedented climate event. I'm working on something else, I told him, the stench of death filling my nostrils. Can I ask what? You cannot.
Doppelganger, A Trip into the Mirror World by Naomi Klein is available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by the author. And once again, Andrew Miller, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I've been lovely to talk to you.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 450 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember, our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.